The book of Nehemiah, chapter 5, and we read from verse 1 through to the end of the chapter. Nehemiah, chapter 5, starting at verse 1. And there was a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren, the Jews. For there were that said, We, our sons and our daughters are many, therefore we take up corn for them, that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, We have mortgaged our lands, vineyards and houses, that we might buy corn because of the dearth. There were also that said, We have borrowed money for the king's tribute, and that upon our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children, and lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants. And some of our daughters are brought unto bondage already, neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. And I was very angry when I heard their cry at these words. Then I consulted with myself and rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, Ye exact usury, every one of his brother, and I set a great assembly against them. And I said unto them, We after our ability have redeemed our brethren the Jews, which were sold unto the heathen. And will ye even sell your brethren? Or shall they be sold unto us? Then held they their peace, and found nothing to answer. And I said, It is not good that ye do. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God, because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? I likewise, and my brethren, and my servants might exact of them money and corn. I pray you, let us leave off this usury. Restore, I pray you, to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, and their houses. Also the hundredth part of the money, and of the corn, the wine, and the oil, that ye exact of them. Then said they, We will restore them, and will require nothing of them. So will we do as thou sayest. Then I called the priest, and took an oath of them, that they should do according to this promise. Also I shook my lap, and said, So God shake out every man from his house, and from his labour, that performeth not this promise. Even thus be he shaken out and emptied. And all the congregation said, Amen, and praised the Lord. And the people did according to this promise. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the twentieth year, even unto the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, that is 12 years, I and my brethren have not eaten the bread of the governor, but the former governors that had been before me were chargeable unto the people, and had taken of them bread and wine besides 40 shekels of silver. Yea, even their servants bear rule over the people. But so did not I, because of the fear of God. Yea, also I continued in the work of this wall. Neither brought we any land, and all my servants were gathered thither unto the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 of the Jews and rulers, beside those that came unto us from among the heathen that are about us. Now that which was prepared for me daily was 1 ox and 6 choice sheep. Also fowls were prepared for me, and once in 10 days store of all sorts of wine. Yet for all this required not I the bread of the governor, because the bondage was heavy unto this people. Think upon me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. And we'll be drawing our message slightly later on in the service from there. We take up our hymn books to sing. Well, I invite you to turn to that passage we read from Nehemiah chapter 5. And we continue on with our studies in this glorious book. To this point, we have seen many reforms and changes to God's people on the nationwide scale. how they responded to those around them. But now the focus changes ever so slightly. And as it were, the narrative looks inside the nation itself, inside the city, as to how things were looking. Just before we come to our first point, in conversion, our natures are fundamentally changed. We know that because we have that wonderful text in 2 Corinthians 5:11. Therefore, if any man or woman or boy or girl be in Christ, they are a new creature. Old things have passed away and all things have become new. This is a crucial part of salvation because by nature we have fallen hearts. Ones that are inclined away from God, away from his morality, his sense of right and wrong, and towards evil, towards those things that displease the Lord. This is why hell is forever. Because God, if you like, removes his constraining hand. Because in this lifetime, every human heart knows to a measure God's restraining hand so that it cannot fully express how anti-God it is. We see it in snippets. We see it in those who are hardened against the message of the Bible. We see it in those who are famously anti-Christian, who go out of their way to try and destroy every single argument made by the Bible. That's, if you like, in part what every heart is capable of. But in hell, God removes that hand of constraint, and the human heart expresses every single hatred against the Lord. And that is why punishment is forever. Because it's not just skin deep. The human condition of sin, I'm not trying to turn this into a gospel address by any means, but we need to consider this for this passage this morning. But the human heart is a spring of evilness, of anti-godness, if we can put it that way. This is why salvation cannot just be change the things on the outside. Salvation has to change the heart of a person, a total change, as we have from that verse in 2 Corinthians. But in conversion, God removes that heart and replaces it with a new heart that is inclined towards him. That sinful spring is replaced by a spring that is, if you like, actioned or emanates from the Lord himself, and it changes the actions, the morals of a person. It's a once and for all declaration of salvation that someone is saved. But the ongoing work of washing away all those old corruptions has only just started, and it only finishes that moment when we cross that threshold, as it were, when we are translated to glory, when we are taken to be with the Lord. Then anything that is left is completely changed at that moment. But this sets off a chain of effects in people's lives. Over time, so much of a person's life changes as God gently shows what's right and what's wrong. But it does take time. Let me give you an example. I'm sure everyone here listening to this message would know of John Newton, the famous hymn writer who wrote Amazing Grace, the slaver turned believer. But I wonder if it would surprise people to know that he actually continued as a slaver for over a year after his conversion. That conversion that happened in the middle of a storm was so powerful, it didn't completely change him all at once. You can read about it in his own writings if you don't believe me. His behaviour changed towards the slaves. He now saw them as human beings rather than as goods. He treated them a lot better than any other person would have ever treated them as a slaver, much different from how he once treated them. But it was only after a little time that he realized slavery in its totality was wrong, and he broke with it for good. And of course went on to pioneer slavery to be completely abolished in the UK, or the British Empire at the time. But what made this happen? It was God working on his heart, which opened his eyes to see the truth and what the Bible had to say about these things. Before we jump to criticise John Newton, he came from a time where slavery was very common, whereas we come from a time where slavery is seen against a crime against humanity, so we shouldn't be too quick to judge him. But let me make a more modern example. We're bombarded all the time in society around us about what we would call dishonesty, the little white lies, the half-truths, so much more that we could go on with. Previous generations had that everything had to be said as truth, that a man's word was his bond, that in everything you did or say, you were as accurate as possible. But we don't live in those times. So here's a direct comparison for us. We live in a day and age where we have to be so much more careful with what we say because there's so much more acceptable social lies that go on around us all the time. Our conscience, if you like, gets numbed to what's around us. It's the same with John Newton in his time. But the answer is still the same, that the Lord is able to renew our hearts and minds to the point that our views are so changed that what is right and wrong to the Lord's standards becomes our new standards. But we also should say as well, as I've remarked, this happens time and time again in a believer's heart as the Lord straightens out our characters. We are saved, we are justified, that work is done, that's once and for all. But the ongoing work of sanctification happens day in, day out, that constantly putting off of the old person, the old nature, and putting off on the new. But this is where it touches this passage, because this process can be interrupted. We have two natures that fight within us. This is very unpopular in certain circles of modern biblical teaching, especially in the States. But it's clearly taught in the Bible, and it has been taught by generations of believers ever since. You can see it all the way back in Genesis, and it runs all the way through the Bible, all the way through church history to the modern day. The Bible uses the imagery of two wrestlers contesting with each other. This is excellent. Of course it is. It's biblical. But two wrestlers that fight against each other. Wrestling is a physical sport. You grapple with each other. You're right next to your opponent. You're doing your best to get a hand on him to try and pin him down on his back, because then that's how you win. You pin your opponent down and you hold him down so that he can't get back up. This is the struggle that fights inside every single believer, and it goes backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. The old nature strives to come back, to reassert itself, to get you back into those sins that happened before conversion. And your new nature fights against it and says, no, I don't want any of these things anymore. I don't want to go back to those things. That's why when sadly we do sin as believers, you feel bad afterwards. Because that new nature, as it were, almost comes back and reasserts itself and says, no, this isn't right. This isn't what I should be doing. I am better than this. The Lord has saved me from these things. That's why there's that aching, that pain. And take courage if you know that, because that is a proof you are saved. If you are not saved and you sin, there will be no pain. There will be no sadness, no regret, remorse afterwards. You may regret, you may show remorse if you're caught, but there won't be that aching in the heart that knows you've done something wrong and you have to set it right with the Lord. But with that in mind, we turn to chapter 5. And I want to consider for a moment hardness in this passage. Chapter 5, verse 1 starts with a hue and a cry. The population of Israel, there is much clamour and unrest because the people are so poor. We get the impression that this has been building up in the population over time. Remember, Nehemiah is a new governor. He didn't come back at the very start and see all the work began at Jerusalem. The work has been carrying on for some years before he arrives. So most in what happens in the society, he's still finding out and discovering. The people are burdened with debts to the extent that they had no money left to buy food. This was a time of rebuilding. There would have been severe costs to everyone, bearing in mind the amount of work that had to be done. The people had been in exile for 70 years. The city was in ruins. To rebuild the city was no small work. It had to be funded. But it wasn't the rebuilding that was dragging them down. It was that they had to have borrowed so much money, and now the interest was due, and they had nothing to pay. So they were risking their own children being sold to make up the payment. Of what had caused this?
It was the usury, as we have in our passage, the crushing interest that the nobles were charging for their money. You recall how Moses had made it very clear in Deuteronomy and in Leviticus that the Jews were free to charge interest to non-Jews, to those people surrounding the nations, as long as the demands were not crushing. But they weren't to charge them to fellow Jews. If a Jew found himself in difficulty, he had debts that he had to pay, he had costs that he had to make up, then those round about him, they lent him money, but they took no interest for it to help him get back on his feet. And then when he was able to repay those debts, and everyone would be satisfied. But not so the nobles here. And when Nehemiah finds out, he is very angry, or he's furious, as we have. The text is almost a little tame. He might well be. But here he is trying to reform the nation, to bring them back into line with God's standards. And the very people who were the most responsible in society had set an example that was blatantly breaking God's very clear command. The noble class, who had rulings over most aspects of life, the political life, the judiciary, the welfare, the guidance, these were the ones who had no regard for the standards of God. That was bad enough. But there's something even worse. You can see in the attitudes of these people how cruel the rates were. The commoners, if we can say it like that, had already lost control of their lands, which was how they would generate the money to pay the mortgages. So now their own children were at risk of being taken away. Think of that for a moment, how hard these nobles were. They had children of their own, and yet they were willing to take away children from other people's families, all to enrich themselves. There was no pity, there was no concern, there was as yet no pang of, look at what we're doing, we shouldn't be doing this. They were hard and they were cruel. Now maybe you could argue that the common people could have not taken the deal in the first place, but did they really have any options if they didn't want to lose anything or everything? How had they got to this stage, you may ask? Because sin doesn't start off like this. I'm sure none of the ruling class, none of the nobles, ever started off with these terms. But it happened little by little. Well, you say one of the first reasons is they stopped feeling for those around them, for the other Israelites. You can imagine them in their sturdy houses, these nobles, with all their material wealth, with no concerns. They didn't know what it was like to worry over the future, to have concerns, or to be in great difficulty. But also they'd left off their love for the Lord. If they truly loved the Lord in an active, vibrant way, their hearts would have felt that this was wrong. How can I treat my fellows this way when the Lord treats me so kindly? But this can happen in churches and in individuals today. Have you noticed how few believers seek to win the lost for the Lord? In the New Testament, the terminology of the church, the hard labour, is just that. It's hard toil. The picture is almost farming of a bygone age, where the workers were out in the heat of the day, ploughing, weeding, tending, all done with simple tools, back-breaking work, constant hard work, and it took great effort. The labour of the New Testament church is exactly the same in a spiritual sense. The church has been described as a college to train new believers, as a hospital to heal unbelievers, but also to heal wounded believers, a drill ground where we learn more about the Bible, more about God, a barracks, a place of safety and retreat, but above all, a lifeguard post. We live in a place here next to the river. I'm sure most of us understand what the lifeguard do. They're there, they watch the seas, and if someone is in danger or radios in for help, they're off straight away. The boat goes down the ramp, into the water, and off they go to try and save people. It's amazing some of the stories you read of the efforts that have been made in times past. I'm sure this place has got its own tales to tell. I'm more familiar with the ones down in Devon because that's where we spent most of our family holidays. But some of the stories that came out of people who risked their lives to save other peoples, who while they were safe on the shore, put themselves in a place of danger to save others. But when you look around at so many churches, what do you see? Most churches have a combined Bible study and prayer meeting. Heavy on the Bible study, light on the prayer meeting. If the balance is a bit more, then that's fine. But so many churches love the Bible study, and yet there's so few prayers, and even fewer prayers for those made for those who are perishing around us. Maybe there's a small children's work, but it tends to be more for the church children than as a witness. No gospel service, with the odd exception maybe of an occasional friends or family service or a special time of year, say harvest, Christmas, and maybe Remembrance Day if we can squeeze one in. Lots of social events for believers to meet up. Nothing wrong with that in itself. But where is the striving for the local neighbourhood? Part of it, we own, is that so few understand the importance we play in making the gospel known. The work of saving a soul is all of the Lord. With man, this is impossible. I can preach all the services I want. I'm sure our brother, the pastor here, will do exactly the same. He will preach the gospel for years on years, but we cannot save a single soul. We can go out and compel every single person that we meet. We can press Bibles into their hands. We can press tracts into their hands. We can reason with them until we're blue in the face. We cannot save a single soul. This is nothing that we do. But we have a part to play, and it's the Lord's final command to go out and to make disciples, to make people aware of the Bible and the message that it brings. And we own that so few churches don't understand, because of the time we're in, this part. But the larger part of it is how hard we as believers feel towards unbelievers. Why do you think so many brothers or sisters in former ages were minded to serve as missionaries? We know of the famous ones, but how many thousands served the Lord? They left their loved ones behind, even family members, even their own children, or husband or wife, to face countless dangers, disease, calamity, health problems, tyrannical locals, aggressive locals, political regimes, language barriers, cultural barriers, and many thousands of missionaries died. The West Indies was a cholera death sentence. The Far East, where you had typhoid, malaria, yellow fever. There are actually in some countries whole cemeteries that are given over to European missionaries. And when you look at the dates of when they arrived and when they died, it was something like 24 months. If that, 2 years was the average life expectancy of a European missionary. Why did they go and face such hardships? Because of their love for the Lord, but because they felt for human souls who were perishing in darkness, who were dead in this lifetime and without understanding and condemned to a lost eternity. And it moved them to tears and activity. There is a hymn, I'm sure everyone here knows it, by Frank Houghton. We know the famous missionaries to China, Hudson Taylor and all the rest of it. But this man served as the next director of the Inland China Missionary. And this hymn I'm about to read was written as a rally cry to those who are still back home. Facing a task unfinished that drives us to our knees, a need that undiminished rebukes our slothful ease, we who rejoice to know thee renew before thy throne the solemn pledge we owe thee to go and make thee known. And then this verse, it's always struck me. Where other lords beside thee held their unhindered sway, where forces that defied thee defy thee still today, with none to heed their crying for life and love and light, unnumbered souls are dying and pass into the night. And then it goes on to remind those that we bear the torch that flaming fell from the hands of those who gave their lives proclaiming that Jesus died and rose. Ours is the same commission, the same glad message ours. Fired by the same ambition, to thee we yield our powers.
O Father who sustained them, O Spirit who inspired, Saviour whose love constrained them to toil with zeal untired, from cowardice defend us, from lethargy awake, forth on thine errand send us to labour for thy sake. The man who wrote this, he knew exactly what it was to serve, but he also knew how hard and how easy it is to forget those around us who are perishing. In spite of all the hardships and burdens, in spite of the hostility and near isolation of the work, these brothers and sisters volunteered to go and serve the Lord. But we don't have to look that far to see examples in our own land. You think of the Salvation Army as it was originally founded. They dared to go where no sane person would go, to spread the word in rookeries, in places where violence was rampant, where there was murders and thefts on a daily basis. And yet these people had the great courage to go into these areas to speak to the Lord. The local councils and authorities had given up. They'd never send their people in there because they were too dangerous. But these people from the Salvation Army, they were brave enough to go there. You think of Whitfield and Wesley, both preaching in the open air to miners of all people. These men and women who were so rough that their animals were used to being sworn at, to being kicked at, to being treated harshly. Yet when these people were saved, their own animals didn't recognise them because the change was so much. And there's a wonderful picture that Wesley and Whitfield both talk about. The faces of these men and women, because they never washed, because they were always constantly down the mines, they were thick with grime, thick with blackness, and yet there were white lines running down their faces where the tears were trickling through and washing the grime away. That's how much these men had an effect, but it was the Lord, obviously. And then there are the countless acts that believers who love the Lord and who have felt for those around them. And they went to extremes to spread the word. I can go one step further. I can give the supreme example. Why did Christ come to this world? Why should one of the Trinity, who created this world with a word, why should the Almighty, infinite God, contract himself down and consent to be born as a helpless child? Born in a palace? No, to a poor family. To be laid in a manger because there was no room in the inn. Why would the noblest person in this world consent to be mocked by the religious hypocrites who should have known better? To be misunderstood even by his most loyal followers and then crucified at Calvary, a death that was designed to prolong the suffering? Because in his great compassion, he felt for men and women, boys and girls, as a father pities us or feels for his children, so the Lord feels for us. I heard something recently. It was a picture someone was talking about. I'm sure everyone here will know about the eruption at Pompeii that happened many thousands of years ago. Before the eruption at Pompeii, all that the volcano threw out, in Latin they didn't actually have a word for volcano. It was that terrible that they actually coined a word from Pompeii, where in a matter of moments there was ash, heat, steam thrown out by the volcano. The local villagers and inhabitants fled down to the sea thinking that they could escape there. But because it was all downhill, this great cloud of ash and steam swept through the area, vaporizing anyone in front of them. You wonder, well, what has this got to do? But in the middle of these ruins, there are so many expressions of love. There is one where a mother is trying to protect her baby, and possibly a father is trying to protect them. They never stood a chance. But this is the length that people will go to as one another to protect them. How much more should we feel for those around us who are perishing in sin? The same love that drove Christ to save us should drive us to save those around us. You ask me how to apply the nobles charging usury on their fellow Jews today? The hardness that they felt reflects the hardness we so often feel for those around us. We have been given life everlasting.
But the kindness that God has to us is for all people. It comes at no cost to us. The only thing we lose is our sin. All expenses paid for. The promise given to us is unbreakable. And yet, how often do we balk at telling others? And I put myself firmly here as well. We are in and around the world constantly, and it's so easy to become numb to the plight of those around us, especially with how uninterested so many are. Oh, I'm waiting for the Lord to reveal himself to me. Okay, how would you envision that happens? I don't know, but God, who is perfect, he should know how to get through to me. Or, I want to live my life first, and then I'll come to the Lord. Or, that's okay for you. You believe what you want, but it's just not for me. I'm offering you life everlasting, to live with the Lord perfectly forever, to know his blessing in this life. And you turn it down almost as though it's an offer for nothing. How the Lord bears with people, but how easy it is for us to become numb. Or how anti so many are. They trot out all the old lines. The Bible, the God of the Bible, is cruel and unjust. The Bible has been corrupted over the years. The contradictions of lives of supposed believers and the reality. We've heard them all. I don't need to rehearse them all. But we are also constantly surrounded by sin, and our consciences grow cold to how sinful sin is. How often we hear the Lord's name taken in vain, even by the children around us in the street, and it doesn't sting us. How often we hear the sludge on the TV or the adverts around us or in common talk, and it doesn't make us wince, knowing that, as it were, these people are almost committing spiritual suicide because every sin is laid up time and time again, and we do nothing to try and throw ourselves into the way to say, do you not realise what you're doing? The God who you insult now would be the same God who saves you, just to give one example. And then there is how often we pull back from saying something that we could have said. There's always the time after the conversation when you think, oh, I should have said that. But how often do we remember that thing? Do we even jot it down? So that when the question comes up again, because the questions go round and round, that's something I've noticed, you've got the answer ready to be able to use it. Or you say to yourself, Lord, if you will give me another opportunity, I will say what I was going to say. How often do we feel that, I wonder? But also look at it from the opposite side. How many believers who are believers now, humanly speaking, owe their conversion to a friend or a family member? There was a lovely West Indian lady at the church I grew up in. A very tall lady, nearly as tall as me. And for years she lived up the opposite end of the road to the church. And there was an old lady who lived in the same street. And every Sunday she would say to this lady, come to church, come to church, come to church. It took years and years before that lady would actually go to church. And by her own record, she says she only went because this person bothered her so much about it. In the end, she gave up and said, right, I'll go along once and then that will be it. I'll keep this lady quiet and she'll leave me alone. She went back again and again and again. And now she is a lovely believer in the Lord. You never know what the Lord will do with what you do. The smallest thing that is done for him can turn into the most remarkable thing. Because with the Lord, with man, this is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. A pastor I know, if I've said it before, I apologise, but I always find it incredible. Someone put a trap through his door. He has no idea who it was. I doubt the person who put it through the door would ever think of it again. A simple thing of putting the tract through the door. The man picked the tract up, started reading it. He picked the family Bible off the shelf where it had been sat for many years. He opened it, he started reading. Him, his wife, and their two children came to saving faith. And now he's a pastor and serving the Lord and going on with the Lord strongly. We have no idea how the Lord will use even the smallest, seeming weakest things that we do for him. But we also see the hardness in our own lives to sin. It's so easy for sin to become such a small thing in our lives. Our times with the Lord lack their life.
lack their vitality.
We become formal and cold, and then sin starts to encroach. You can be sure as soon as Satan senses any kind of coldness in your heart towards the Lord, he'll start encroaching in. Those tendrils, those weeds will start growing in and start creeping in. Slowly at first, and I'll bet that's happened. How it happened with these nobles. We'll charge something reasonable first, something small, just for the bother. And it grew and grew and grew until they ended up where they did, the state they were. But there's also another way which we see this hardness, or can see this hardness, is how we treat one another. There is no such thing as a perfect church. We all know that. If you ever find a perfect church, run away from it, because there's something wrong. Every church has its own quirks and problems because it's made up of imperfect sinners. You put a group of imperfect sinners together in one room, of course the result isn't going to be perfect. There always will be problems. But there is a world of difference between a church where believers love one another and feel for one another over a church where there is hardness between the believers, where there is no talking amongst each other, where there is no finding out how the week's gone so that we can pray for people, where there is no support, where there is no help given or help offered around the membership, where there isn't that unifying around Christ, because that's the key thing that holds a local church together. We love fellow believers because we see that reflection in them of Christ. That's why even if you meet a believer who you've never met before, there is almost a feeling of kinship. Sometimes, before they've even said that they are a believer, there's like a small thing inside of you that goes, I really wonder if that person is actually a believer because of how they conduct themselves. Because even though you don't know it consciously, you're seeing that reflection of Christ. And because you love Christ, you love that person as well. That's why you feel a kinship with believers, regardless of what background they come from, regardless of where they come from in the world, how old they are, how young these are. The differences that sometimes come between believers happen after you're saved. But in that first, there is that love, there is that kinship with every believer, because we all love the Lord. And this is why the root of this problem with hardship is always first and foremost a lack of love for the Lord. Because if we allow our love for the Lord to grow cold, then hardness starts creeping in. And it starts creeping in with everything. All I can say is, in conclusion, keep a watch of your heart. If there's any signs of hardness in it, attend to it straight away. Ask the Lord for help. He understands our hearts. He understands we go through times when our love waxes or wanes. And he's there to help. That's why the Lord didn't just give his spirit for a time. He gave it forever until we're safe home in glory. We have the Lord with us day by day through every trouble, every difficulty. So often it's never the failing of the Lord that his spirit isn't willing and able to help us. More often than not, it's our failure to apply it in our lives. And yes, it is difficult. Yes, it is hard. Look, we've gone right back to the beginning with the two natures that fight each other. Every day, every moment of our lives between here and eternity, we are involved in that fight. We must never give up and never give in, because the cost is too much. If we are compromised as believers, however can we be used as signposts? However can we be used to point others towards the Lord? This is the real sadness if we surrender in that battle with our old nature and new nature, because the Lord cannot use us as a witness. He cannot do amazing things in our lives if we don't strive for him. So strive all the harder, and you never know what the Lord might do with your life. Let's sing our final hymn this morning, which is hymn 559.